supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Common Space.
Oh, my God.
They're still shooting.
We left just in time.
It was three things. The deadliest mass shooting by a single shooter in U.S. history. The deadliest terrorist attack in the U.S. since 9/11. And the deadliest incident of violence against LGBTQ people in U.S. history. 49 people were killed and 58 people were wounded. And it all happened in one day, June 12, 2016, in Orlando, Florida. I'm your host, Jamie J., with WHYY's Elizabeth Perez Luna. And this episode of Common Space is all about the LGBTQ experience.
Yes, Jamie, let's face it. It has never been easy to be a member of the LGBTQ community. Even these days, it seems that for every victory in cementing the civil rights for this group, a new act of legislative regression or unspeakable violence tells a different story.
Just what is it that inspires such rage and anger toward our fellow LGBTQ citizens? Seems to me like we all want the same thing in life, to be loved, happy, and safe. Anissa Weinraub told a story that reminds me that in so many ways, gay or straight, we're all alike in our need for love. And that first love, no matter who you are loving, is awkward, scary, and thrilling all at once. Here's Anissa.
So this is actually about my first ex-girlfriend. And the story starts, like many queer women, in a high school softball dugout. It was the mid-90s, and I was living in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I was a freshman in high school, and the junior varsity team season had already ended, and I got called up to the big leagues, to the varsity, because they wanted to show me the ropes. And let's just say I got shown a few different kinds of ropes that summer. So I was in the dugout telling jokes to the other teammates to get them to like me, and there was this 6-foot-tall, like, long-haired butch girl, kind of like super athlete named Kathy Hoverman. And there was something about her that reminded me of this other person I knew, Christy Comstock. So real quick, Christy Comstock I met at Jewish day camp. And, hey, tell it. She was actually the first openly queer, gay queer person that I'd ever met. And I thought she was so cool and so smart and so fierce and so hot. And it was really confusing for me. So there I was in the dugout, and I don't know what it was. It was maybe her hand gestures or her finely chiseled jaw line. But I was like, there was a spark. And so I looked at her and I was like, you remind me of my friend Christy Comstock. The subtext was obvious. Christy is gay, and are you gay? And am I gay? And can we be gay together? And somehow she didn't realize the subtext, and she just kind of looked at me like, cool, and ran out to get her a position in center field. And so there I stood in the dugout, kind of peering out over the horizon of my life. And, she made this really amazing catch, like, leapt for it. And I don't know what it was. It was, like, the universe or the goddess or, like, whatever. It just kind of streamed into me and outburst. If Kathy Hoverman were gay, I'd go for her. What? I looked around. There was only one other person in the dugout. Amanda Munch. That's really her name, Amanda Munch. I know, it's like I'm on The Simpsons or something, but that really was her name. It's the Midwest, I don't know. So Amanda Munch looks at me and she's like, I'm totally telling her. And I took every ounce of conviction and integrity that I had, and I looked at her and I said, do it. And in that moment, that dusty dugout, I took control of the rest of my life. And thus went my summer of courtship. So let me just tell you, I was 15, somewhere straddled between Nirvana and the Lilith Fair. Like a rabid vegetarian, anti-military, like environmentalist, and I loved musical theater. Kathy Hoferman, she had just graduated high school. She was in the junior ROTC. She wanted to grow up and be either like a bomber, fighter, pilot, or like a professional soccer player. So it was like a match made in heaven. And I would just like every morning strap on my rollerblades and like rollerblade over to her house and put little love notes on her car. Oh, okay, whatever. And, or we would go out on like friend dates and I would try to charm her with like my quirky precociousness. And, you know, we both kind of edged nearer and nearer to this attraction, this question mark, but we were both too scared to do anything about it. Until the end of the summer, she was about to go off to college. I know. And the tension had just been building up and it reached this boiling point. And she was house-sitting for this very, very Christian family that lived in her neighborhood. I mean, I'm telling you, people, they had on every surface either a Bible, like a cross-stitch saying about sin, or like Precious Moments figurines featuring like heteronormative family. And I was like, cool. And she took me on a tour and we ended up in the bedroom. And she looked at me and she was like, do you want a massage? And I was like, yes, I do. And so I laid down on this bed covered in a sheet of Jesus fish. Really, for real. And all I remember was like, just like the moment of her hands. And then I don't even know what happened, and we were just making out. And it was like, boom, boom, boom. It was amazing. I mean, objectively speaking, it was really awkward. But, like, it was amazing, right? And it floored me, and I just, like, ran out of the house, and I was frolicking in the summer rain, and I was, like, singing I Kissed a Girl. And I'm not talking about that Katy Perry bullshit. I'm talking about the authentic, original Jill Sobule feminist anthem. Anyway, so we broke up. And I could tell you all the stories of how she became my ex, but, you know, it's really not the point. Today, I think that the point is, like, you know, we all have a slew of exes. Some of us more than others. And, you know, we could always just focus on the negative, heartbreaking, crushing story where we're dashed of our hopes and our dreams about love. But then we really miss these sweet moments, you know, whether they be in a dusty dugout or evangelical bedroom, where we find love in a hopeless place. And so I'm trying to like curry favor with the universe to put out positive energy. And we'll see, right? So next year, if I'm not here telling a story about my ex, we'll know it worked. Thank you.
Anissa Weinraub is an educator, organizer, and performer. She told me she spends her days working with teenagers as a high school English and theater teacher. She also tries to be the queer mentor to her students that she wished she'd had. You can catch her telling stories on stage at Story Slams and in the streets at protests and marches.
Everyone has a coming out story. It's a rite of passage in LGBTQ life. Let's welcome our guest, Amber Hikes, Philadelphia's Executive Director of the Office of LGBT Affairs. She has a vivid memory of her own coming out rite of passage.
So coming out it's a lifelong process. And I would say as a femme-identified person and a femme-presenting person, I have to come out on a regular basis. People assume that I am straight because of how I look. So I'd come out to my mother in terms of my family first. And it's a funny story because I didn't have this whole plan where I was going to come out. I'd been dating a woman for about a year, but it wasn't until the following January that my mother actually asked me when I was trying to get off the phone to go to a Super Bowl party that my girlfriend and I were hosting, if I had anything that I wanted to tell her. And she and I said, no, we cleared up everything, told you how finals went, and told you what classes I'm taking and what's going on with my friends. And she says, is there anything you want to tell me personally, like, is there anything maybe about your relationship? It's, oh, no, I'm not dating anybody. I'm not seeing anybody. She says, okay, I'm just going to have to walk you through this, I guess.
Wow. So I'm going to want to hear about how your mother walked you through this because, yes, you know, people that are going to be listening, mm-hmm. you know, are going to be listening for guidance and for direction sure. and be looking up to you.
I've heard a lot of coming out stories over the years, and I'm so blessed and honored when I get to hear someone's process. But I haven't heard many folks have their parents walk them through it in this way. So I find that this was very unique for me. So my mother, it was very simple. She actually just wanted me to say, "Mom, I'm gay." But I was not ready to say that. And so she very literally said, "Okay, just repeat after me. Mom." I said, "All right, Mom, I'm gay." What's interesting now that I think of it is that I never finished that sentence. I never actually said it. I just broke down and bawled. And all I did say was, "I'm sorry. I'm so, so sorry. I don't mean to disappoint you. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry."
So, okay. I want to know why you felt that way, and did she agree with you or not?
I felt like I'd let her down because my mom was an incredibly high achiever. She was very, very impressive, several degrees, and was at that time was the vice president of Spelman College, which was her alma mater, and then was later the vice president of Virginia Tech. And I had done right by her in all things, right? So I was a student athlete, and I graduated from college with high honors and had a scholarship and was doing exactly what she wanted me to do. But just like most parents, she wanted me to be straight and marry a sweet boy that was equally as successful and, you know, become Barack and Michelle Obama II. And I knew that this was not in the plan that she had for me. I knew that very clearly. And so I felt even though I was a straight edge kid, no drinking, no drugs, I still knew that this was a letdown. I was fortunate in that she did not confirm that belief. She said that she loved me no matter what, and that she supported me, and we were going to be okay. And she did. And on the other side of it, like I said, she was a vice president of a college at the time, and her own college was having some issues with hate crimes on their campus. And she was a vice president of student affairs. And she brought these issues to me and said, "This is the response. This is my office's response to these issues. This is how we're going to be supporting the LGBT office and these students. And if you were on my campus, would you feel validated and supported by this response? Or is there something more that I should be doing?" And I remember being so proud of her and wishing that I had an ally like that on my campus. So it was a beautiful demonstration that coming out reverberates for people, right? So my coming out helped my mother be a better ally and then affected change for thousands of students on that campus.
Thanks for sharing your story, Amber. You are listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY, and it's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. I'm your host, Jamie J, with WHYY's Elizabeth Perez Luna. History tells us our fellow LGBTQ citizens have suffered from banishing and imprisonment to massive annihilation during the Holocaust. Remember, there were pink triangles as well as those yellow stars.
But tragically, it's not only the past we're talking about. I'm thinking of the recent wave of repression in the Russian Republic of Chechnya. As reported by the BBC, gay men have been rounded up in concentration camps, tortured, and even killed.
Dozens of homosexual men are disappearing in Chechnya. That's according to human rights activists and a leading opposition newspaper in Russia. Some are being arrested, tortured, and even killed by police because of their sexuality. The report claims that more than 100 people have been detained in an anti-gay campaign. A spokesman for the Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov has denied the report, adding there are no gay people in Chechnya.
Yeah, right. And if there are no LGBTQ people, there can't be violence against them, right? Tell that to Aaron Stella, who has a story about a chance encounter gone way bad in Coleman, Alabama.
Let's take a way back machine to Alabama. I believe this was the year 2002. I'm walking home from school this day. It is late in the evening. It's already dark. and I'm going to the community playhouse where I'm going to participate in one of the community plays there for Cullman, Alabama. This is a completely German-founded town, and if you can't tell, I'm rather Jewish-looking, so I could only be cast as a narrator for this story. Funny enough. Anyways, on my walk home, I encounter this sort of young, waifish-looking boy, kind of cute in a way, foppish hair, still very like wraith-like and thin and kind of small. And he approaches me and he says, "Listen, would you mind walking me to the back end of my house, which is a little bit farther across this park called Heritage Park, which is in Cullman, Alabama?" And I said, "Yeah, sure, it's fine." So we begin to walk. It's a rather warm night. And, you know, me being, you know, an openly gay man now here in Cullman, Alabama, probably not the best idea. I begin to somewhat flirt with him. And, you know, he's a nice guy, and we sort of have a somewhat lively conversation. Well, as we begin to reach the opposite periphery of Heritage Park, suddenly he runs off into the distance, and I can't see him. I can barely make out the fur of the conifer trees that are surrounding the opposite end of this periphery. And before I know anything, before I could run off after him, suddenly I see 12 bright headlights flicker on. And I'm like, "What the f***? What's going on?" They're all trucks. All of them are trucks. The boy, now I can see, because he's illuminated by some of these lights, he goes up to the driver and in one of these trucks and talks to him for a second. He suddenly cranes his body outside of the window, and he has a bat. And he looks at me, and he points it to me like a medieval knight with a sword. He's like, "That's him." I'm like, "Whoa!" And I just start running the other direction. I don't know what's going on. All the trucks start taking off for me. All at once. All I can hear is a roar in back of me. It's one of these traumatizing experiences where the rest of your senses just sort of go dead, and all you hear is sound, and feel just like the vigor of your feet just like trotting onward. I run to the other edge of the park, and I hide in a grove of bushes. I don't know what's going on still in this case. I huddle there, and I whip out my cell phone, and I call my friend who I was living with, and I say, "Man, I don't know what's going on. You have to come and get me. People are after me. I'm at the edge of Heritage Park. I told them to cross streets, just come and get me." I'm sitting there in the bushes. The six cars are rounding the park, just constantly, almost in a perfectly regimented train, looking for me. I can hear just the faint sort of like whispers and like and weird sort of like search calls of like where they're looking for me. I don't know what to do. Finally, I see a small Miata pull up, and I know it's my friend's car. So I run up to him. I go to my friend, I'm like, "What the f***?" And he says, "Just get in the trunk." So I hop in the trunk of his car. As I'm there, my friend, I can hear him leaning against the trunk of the car, and the people who were in the trucks come up and talk to him. As it turns out, Cullman, Alabama is actually the place that the KKK relocated after Birmingham. They had caught word that I was a gay man in Cullman, Alabama, and they begin to talk with him, with my friend, and they're like, "You know, man, you've heard about this faggot who's here in town, and we've been looking for him, and he was just talking to this dude." The guy, by the way, who I've been talking to the whole time, was the Grand Dragon's son of the sect in Cullman, Alabama. Of all the people to flirt with, of all the people for me to have this romantic fantasy, I choose the Grand Dragon's son. And he's sitting there. I'm listening. I'm shaking. I don't know what's going to go on. I fall asleep. Next thing I know, I wake up. My friend opens the trunk, and it's just him. We're out in the middle of a field of goldenrods, and he just, like, pulls me out of the trunk. We don't say anything. We go back to his house. We drag a mattress out to the middle of this field of goldenrods, and we just lay there, and we don't say anything. The night sky is over us. Eventually, we begin to start up a fire, and we just talk. And the weird thing about this whole experience is that it wasn't something that was traumatizing. It was just me running away from evil. Complete evil. Nothing that was emotionally traumatizing, just something I knew I had to get away from. And this all exists. That's the crazy part of it. It all still exists to this day. My mom does not know this story, so I'm going to show her this video later. This is how she'll find out. But I am very glad to have the experience of telling you people this story. And that's it.
Aaron told his story at a story slam on the theme, Busted.
You know, Aaron's story resonated with our guest, Amber Hikes, executive director of the Philadelphia Office of LGBT Affairs, who identifies as queer. Amber's eyes dropped to the floor as she listened to Aaron's story and her own memory was resurrected.
We were driving home from a grocery store, and this was when we were living in Louisiana, and they were outside just on the road with signs that said horrendous things about black people. And I remember my mom screaming, you know, curse words at them and being visibly shaken. And I had heard about the KKK. I obviously had learned about them as well in school, but had never seen them until this point. And they had their hoods on and everything. There were some people that were not hooded, but most of them, white hoods in their, you know, and in their robes. And my mother was shaken for the rest of the day. And I remember having vivid nightmares that were reoccurring nightmares for the next 6 years about the KKK. Because up until that point, they had always been this idea, right? So this idea of the past. I didn't realize that they still had an active chapter where I lived in Louisiana. I didn't realize that they were that close to me, because this was, I remember it vividly, and I don't always have the best memory about that time in my life, but they were one block, and this was kind of in like more rural Louisiana, but they were one block from what would have been the turn in to my street. And that's where those nightmares came from. They are physically, geographically close to being able to come in my house and kill me. And it was so disturbing. So I appreciated Aaron's story that was, he did a very good job of making it lighthearted, I think, to a certain extent. But for me, there was nothing that was lighthearted about the Klan. I mean, I had a persistent fear of the Klan until I was like 25. Yeah. It wasn't until then they just became a joke and I saw them for what they were. But it's pretty traumatizing, yeah.
You know, traumatizing is a word that came up often for the storytellers of this episode. And it amazed me how storytellers like Christian Xavier Lovehall found a way to use humor to tell a story about their own self-discovery. I mean, before he understood sex and gender, he knew what made him happy. The trauma came later.
So growing up, I was never the kid who got a lot of toys. So I was a fan of food and snacks that came with prizes. You know, like cereal that got a toy in it, you know, Cracker Jacks. But my favorite was the Happy Meal. I remember my first Happy Meal. I was about 5 years old, and I was sitting in my mom's car. It was in a drive-thru. She rides up to the window, and the lady asks, "What type of Happy Meal would you like? Is this a Happy Meal for a boy or a girl?" I didn't really understand the question, but my mom answers, "Girl." So I get my Happy Meal, I open it up, I see a Barbie doll. I don't want to play with Barbie dolls. So maybe I just got a bad Happy Meal this time. Second time, open it up, My Little Pony. I don't want to play with My Little Pony. Third time, again she says, "Girl." Open it up, Cinderella. Now I was really confused because I'm like, these are called Happy Meals, right? I'm not happy. What's going on? False advertisement, I don't know. So one day we go inside and I see a young boy about my age. His mom orders him a Happy Meal. And she says, "Boy." So I was curious. I watched this little boy open his Happy Meal. And he pulls out a red, black and yellow Hot Wheels race car toy. That is a toy. So I figured it out. My mom is just saying the wrong Happy Meal password. You have to say "boy" to get the cool toys. Remember? So I tell my mom, I said, "Mom, I want a boy Happy Meal." And she looks at me embarrassed and upset and says, "Those are for boys only." Something inside of me broke at that very moment. I cried hysterically. I got dragged out of McDonald's that day. And for some time this continued. And I feel like at one point my mom got tired of beating me for my tantrums and fits. And she decided to let me get a boy Happy Meal. Under one condition. When we in the drive-thru and she pulled up to the window, I had to duck down on the floor because she didn't want the cashier to see that she was ordering a boy Happy Meal for a girl. It was fun at first. I even made a game out of it. But after a while, I internalized a lot of self-hatred, shame. I felt like I wasn't normal. It took a really long time to learn to love myself. Being seen as the gender you are for many transgender people is an important thing. Many in our community call it passing, when you're a passable male or a passable female. In my case, it was when the she's were replaced with he's. But I never really felt that I passed until one night in South Philly. I came outside the crib and went to the store. Was getting me some dinner, some Chinese-American cuisine. Chicken wings and french fries. And yeah, homemade iced tea. Do not forget my Lucy. But I left the store, crossed the street, wanted to head home. All of a sudden, this police wagon pulls in front of me on the actual sidewalk. Two cops get out. I ask them, why am I being stopped? I was told I was being stopped because I was jaywalking. Now, that was very strange to me. Because everybody in Philadelphia jaywalks. Okay? It's usually how you can tell the Philadelphians from the tourists, right? The tourists, they walk up to the street light and wait till it turns green and they cross. You know, we just look and see if there's any cars coming and we walk it. So after he told me that, they pushed me down to the ground, put handcuffs on me. I'm yelling at the top of my lungs, why are you doing this? Why am I on the ground? The cop says, oh, you don't want to be on the ground? Get in a wagon then. They throw me in a wagon, close the door. Smells like urine, feces, vomit, blood. I'm in there for 30 minutes. When they open the door, they let me out. They uncuff me. They give me 3 tickets, totaling $360. One for jaywalking, one for not having an updated address on my ID, and one for disorderly conduct, because my screams disturbed the neighbors. Policemen gave me my food back. By then it was cold and I had lost the appetite. But that night, I knew that I passed as a black man. I knew also that to protect and serve didn't necessarily apply to someone who looked like me. Someone young, black, and men. So my safety is now of a concern. And I'm going to continue on this journey, this revolutionary journey, because I do feel that I have a place in hip-hop as a transsexual male. On stage, I go by the name Words, the poet MC, and I do got bars.
Christian Xavier Lovehall is a black trans man from Philly. He's known for his poetry, music, and freedom fighting. Under his stage persona, Words the Poet MC, he's dedicated his career to art for social change.
Words the Poet MC. Yes. Yeah. People always trying to change the game, but it's really all the same. Listen. I'm feeling like the Fresh Prince. My daddy ain't want me either.
So I was an excellent tomboy. I beat every boy in my fifth grade class at arm wrestling. I nailed them.
Christian Lovehall and Kylan Mettler just want to be seen and accepted for who they are. Who doesn't? But in this case, remaining a mystery might have been for the best.
But by the time I got to college, I got really sick of being called he because it made me feel kind of ashamed and not so attractive. So I came up with this great plan. I would go out and I'd buy a lot of like really sexy feminine clothes that were like short and kind of revealing. And that would, you know, help me with this problem. But I would go out shopping, and instead of going to like trendy female stores, I'd end up in like thrift stores. And instead of buying like sexy short skirts, I would end up buying overalls. So my plan didn't go as I had hoped, and I sort of was getting an F minus in college in femininity. And this all changed when I met Clint. See, Clint was not your average gender studies professor. In fact, he was a hitchhiker I picked up on I-70 going towards Memphis, and he was a little dirty, and as soon as I picked him up, I regretted it. He got in the car, and I started thinking about the only ways that this could end would maybe be murder or rape or mugging would probably be the best one. So we're driving along, and I realize not only is this a bad idea, but he's also the worst listener I've ever met, or else on a lot of drugs, because he asks me the same three questions over and over and over again. He's like, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I work at a bronze foundry. What is that? It's where you make statuary out of bronze. But what do you do? I work at a bronze foundry. And what is that? And it went on and on like this. I won't bore you because I sure was. So the conversation proceeded and he says, are you gay? And I was so surprised I answered yes automatically because it was true. And I then thought, shit, why did I tell him that? Now I'm going to have to add hate crimes to my list of possible endings to this journey. This is horrible. Then he leans way back at the window and he kind of sucks his tail. Dude, I thought you were a chick, dude. Yeah, I get that a lot. Yeah. But dude, you even got hair like a chick, dude. At this point in my life, I had a shaved head that was dyed blue with two little pink ponytails on it, and a heart shape in the back that was dyed red. It was really cool. And I said, yeah, well, I'm a gay artist, so that's how we roll. And he says, but dude, you don't even have any facial hair, dude. You've only got peach fuzz. I say, yeah, all the men in my family, it's a genetic thing. So we're driving, and he says, this is so funny. This is hilarious. I'm going to have to tell the men back at home. I cannot believe when I got in the car, I thought you were so hot. I thought you were such a hot chick, but dude, you are a dude. And I was beginning to identify with this character, this gay male artist that I had created. I was kind of offended, you know? Like, was I not man enough for him? So then he says, do you have a boyfriend? And I say yes, because it was true. And then he says, are you loyal? And I realized two things at that moment. One was that I hadn't solved any problems by pretending to be a boy. In fact, I had probably added to them, and it was going to make a great headline news tomorrow, but that wasn't going to help me at all. And two, that there existed a human being who could have no idea what your gender was and still find you attractive. to the destination, and I'm like looking at my wallet and I'm looking at him and I'm coming up with like really ineffectual battle plans involving like elbows and teeth to like stop him from trying something with me. And he gets out and he opens the door, and later I would realize that he had stolen from me. He stole my assumptions about gender and about attraction, and that later, I would end up dating two trans people and identify as one myself. And I would let go of all this need to be, like, he or she, and I wouldn't really care what people called me because I would be really okay with who I was. And some people go to like great high mountains to find their yogi teachers, but mine came in the form of this dirty old dirt ball I picked up on I-70. And as he slammed the door, Clint leaned his head back in the car and he said, "Dude, you should have been a chick, dude."
Kylan Mettler is an award-winning storyteller with a degree in sculpture from Rhode Island School of Design.
We could just drive around, pack up and leave this town. I don't have it figured out, but we could be beautiful. Oh, it's true, you're the car.
Every encounter doesn't have a funny ending. I'm thinking about that evening in Philadelphia in September of 2014. It made national news when a woman and two of her male friends shouted homophobic slurs and then beat a gay couple in a Center City neighborhood.
Yeah, I remember that.
That beating was so severe that the victims ended up in the emergency room with fractured bones and bruises. The aggressors, well, they ended up in jail. Although she wasn't working for the city at the time, Amber Hikes, who you heard from earlier, is a renowned LGBTQ civil rights activist, and she took note.
Certainly there is still plenty of discrimination outside of the community with regard to LGBTQ people, and as much as we try to combat that, even specifically with this current political climate that we're in, we're seeing ramping up of people's comfort level with being openly discriminatory. And I think that's what's particularly concerning for so many of us in the community is recognizing that these prejudices have existed all along, but a certain people outside of this community are more comfortable being very clear about those prejudices. And that's scary.
How did you become an activist? How did that become an important
career choice?
Yes. Career choice, but also almost a mission. And also you spoke a little bit about teenagers and young people.
Yes.
And that's the most difficult part because I think statistically a lot of teenagers are not welcomed and are kicked out and end up homeless and all that. So how do you decide that you needed to be an activist for these issues?
I appreciate that you brought up youth and young adults in this community. I don't want to get too much in stats and figures, but I think it's important to mention this whenever I can. We know that nationally, in terms of youth who are homeless, 40% of them identify as LGBTQ. That is a massive number. It is a profound overrepresentation. Where we're talking, if we're talking proportionally, that number should only be 6-8%, right? 40% is a profound overrepresentation. When we're talking about Philadelphia, 54%. It's an epidemic. And this is only, we're only talking about youth that are on the street, right? We're not talking about youth that have home insecurity and maybe couch surfing or sleeping on friends' couches and in and out of kind of transitional housing. We're talking about youth on the street. So that number is much higher. And that's terrifying. And to your point, that is due not just in large part, but almost in complete part to youth being kicked out of their homes because they came out as LGBTQ identified. And I could go on and on about youth homelessness and what that looks like for generations of kids who grow up on the streets and how that colors and characterizes the rest of their lives.
And I wonder, Amber, how many people see homeless LGBTQ youth, and any youth really, as someone who has been robbed
mm-hmm.
of the opportunity to develop in a healthy way, in a healthy, accepting environment,
exactly
to
right.
go on to be a productive member of
That's
society.
It. That's it.
They've been robbed of this if they've
Absolutely.
Been kicked out of their home because someone feels that they no longer belong there, which is...
Robbed is exactly right.
That is what's happening.
That's
they
exactly
have been
right.
robbed, and they are trying to... survive and navigate a hostile environment.
That is it. And not, and I mean, everything you said just resonated so deeply, because it's robbed not just of an adolescence or of a childhood. You were robbed of much of your young adult life and possibly your life period, right? Because your life looks very different when you're on the street, and you just talked about survival, fighting for survival. So we know that these youth get involved in what we call survivor crimes. So we're talking about anything from petty shoplifting to sex work. Right? And we're talking about being introduced to drugs, hard drugs, at a much younger age. And it's terrifying. It's terrifying. And when I think about my community, I think about an entire generation, several generations of youth that are our leaders that are having their adolescence and their young adulthood just robbed.
You're listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY, and it's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. I'm your host, Jamie J, with WHYY's Elizabeth Perez Luna.
Being accepted by your community is important, but for storyteller B. Cordelia, the most important thing of all is self-acceptance.
Shower. On the third day of the camping trip, you and your father stay in the yard of the house of your father's cousin Linda and her regrettable husband George, who cracks casually racist and sexist jokes as if they were funny or if they weren't subtly killing you and all your friends. Linda lives with George in a cabin. They are dispatching several trees to keep expanding in the middle of the Hiawatha National Forest, a land named after a peacemaking Native American leader and federally protected by gun-toting white people, because even in nature, colonialism is alive and thriving. You spend too much time indoors over the course of the day, but you also hate the mosquitoes, and who can really live in the outdoors anyway? You think maybe Thoreau was a crackpot. You think maybe this trip was a waste. You pit the radical potential of the wilderness and its utter absence of structure that you believe conducive to healing and freedom or even utopia against George's jokes and the rednecks who populate this peninsula. You think maybe nature, like all else, is a commodity for the privileged. If you can't feel safe amongst the trees and no one, after all, where can you? But you remember all those times that you came up here as a kid to the mythical Upper Peninsula of Michigan, where you first found God and that little seed inside your soul you had already learned too well to bury, and aren't you searching for some shard of yourself that you left out here anyhow? Or perhaps you were never meant to come back to this place after all. Linda, who you like, pours you a glass of wine and says you might be able later to see the aurora borealis, but you think, probably not. These things rarely line up right. You have never before seen the aurora borealis, but you imagine it like an unownable shower of particles and light. On the third evening of the trip, after kayaking down the winding Autrain River 16 miles or more, that morning into afternoon under the hot star sun, and after hiking the day before through sand in the bone-dry heat, and being in more simultaneous places than seems possible, most maliciously mauled by death flies, and for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours, you finally have a place by yourself to shower. You take a moment when you shut the door to look in the mirror as you strip. Your sweaty, smelly clothes, like failed attempts, fall to the floor. No one can see. The part of your chest above your sports bra has been burned by the hot star sun. Your breasts are still small but shapely. Later, you will inject yourself with estrogen in a tent. For now, you have your hands. You feel your breasts. You trace the pink lines your failed attempts left. You turn on and step into the aurora borealis. Particles and light cascade. You realize this is the first time in days you have been naked. You feel yourself naked. You feel your genitals. They are soft in your hand. You feel your shoulders, the skin is tender with red. You feel your feet, They are worn but working. You wash your feet like Jesus did the disciples, but it's just you. Water drips. The Spirit moves. The Aurora Borealis would have been beautiful, but you could not have held it in your hand.
B. Cordelia is an award-winning Chicago-bred writer, performer, educator, and activist. She's currently working on the forthcoming web series, The Tea, with co-creator Daniel Keery and distributor Open TV. You know, there was a time when it was almost inevitable to associate being gay with those three big letters, HIV. But with advances in medicine and care, there have been some positive developments. But attitudes and assumptions haven't changed enough. So I asked Amber Hikes about her thoughts on the state of things today.
If we know anything about the HIV/AIDS crisis and the epidemic that still plagues us today, we know that there is no community that was left untouched by that crisis, and that is still the case here today. So you cannot point blame at a particular community. None of us escaped that crisis. And I say this understanding as a Black woman that Black women, Black men, Latino men, we are still contracting at rates that are higher than other populations. And that's the reality of that that epidemic. And pointing fingers at certain communities and kind of spitting that vitriol, which is what I would call it, it's not only ignorant, but it's very dangerous. It's very dangerous. And that kind of stigma is what contributes to people continuing to die and continuing to be infected with this disease. So that's what I would say to people that continue to spit that kind of hate and ignorance, is that none of us have escaped that epidemic. And we will continue to be in that same situation if we don't raise the level of consciousness and awareness around the disease.
Longevity and survival was not part of the story of HIV in those early decades, though now for some it absolutely is. Mark Davis remembers the early 80s when HIV was first noticed and was described as the gay cancer. He's seen a lot of LGBTQ history since then.
Mike Greenley, he was the neighborhood kid that told me there was no Santa Claus. There was no Easter Bunny. There was no Tooth Fairy. He blew my bubble. And when I asked my mom about it, we always had those end-of-the-driveway conversations about 25 yards before we get to our house. And each time was devastating, lots of trauma. And then he told me about the birds and the bees. And I didn't want to believe it. And when Mom and I had that conversation, I said, "You mean, yeah?" And I didn't understand why it seemed so gross to me, because I ended up coming out later as a gay man. So I guess it was more the bees and the bees and the birds and the birds. So that was the reality of my childhood being shattered in Urbana, Ohio. In 1981, I remember reading, I swear it was a mimeograph paper, about a gay cancer that was in New York and Los Angeles. And I was in a bathhouse in Toledo, Ohio. How was that going to affect me? Growing up in the closet in a small town and a small university, we went to parks and bathhouses and roadside rest and bars that might have had just a light bulb to identify where it was with no name. It was a treacherous lifestyle to live. So that was the way I took it at the time and kind of didn't pay attention until later on in the 80s. And I can say today that 25 years ago, Friday, will be my 25th anniversary of living with HIV. How about that? I'll never forget that day. The Tuesday after Labor Day, the blood was drawn, and it took 3 weeks back then. Now you can almost get it within minutes, the test results. I walked into the doctor's office. He opened the chart. HIV was written in large letters, so I knew right away. I came back to my office and said to my coworker, John, I'm positive. And he said, oh, that's great, that's great. And I said, John, I'm HIV positive. He knew I was going for the test, but he thought a situation had come out positive that we were working on. He was devastated, and I had to take him to lunch to support him rather than him supporting me. And we've talked about that for years ever since. And that afternoon, I received an award from the Pennsylvania Association of Rehabilitation Facilities. It was so hard to stand there in shock and receive the President's Award in front of family and friends and coworkers and people from throughout the state of Pennsylvania. Then the staff people from PARF, the association, we took an aerobics class together at 12th Street Gym. And I knew about a support group sponsored by ActionAids at St. Mark's Episcopal Church on Locust Street. And I was able to get right to that group on the first night. Back when half of this side of the room smoked, this side of the room didn't. And people were dropping like flies. And I made the decision to go off AZT, and I think that was probably the best decision. Because 25 years later, I'm living with it, and I'm thriving. And I'm getting older, and it's nice to get older or aging things like cataracts. Fun. But I think of Ronald Reagan, whose administration for 7.5 years said nothing. After the announcement by the CDC on June 5th, 1981, ironically, Ronald Reagan died on June 5th. Poetic justice? Yes, it was. The next day was D-Day, and everybody would say, oh, that was Reagan-esque. But I'm proud to say that that part of it is over, and the struggle goes on. And I feel blessed, having lost so many friends and family. 5 people from my small graduating class were within a 5-year range. We're alive. And we got mad as hell and we said we're not going to take it anymore. Silence equals death and knowledge equals power. Thank ACT UP for doing what they've done. And thank all for doing what you've done to make it a better life for millions of people, despite Ronald Ronnie Reagan.
You know, the truth is we may always be faced with violence, discrimination, and persecution. But can our actions today make things better in the future? The owner of the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, where that tragic shooting occurred, has opted to create a memorial on the property so that we will always remember those that lost their lives. And that's pretty cool. Right on. You've been listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY, and it's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. Common Space includes a monthly broadcast and podcasts available online at acommonspace.org. That's acommonspace.org. It's also available on iTunes and Stitcher. Please subscribe. And while you're listening, give us a rating. I'm Jamie Brunson, host and co-writer of Common Space. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer of Common Space and co-writer. Our Common Space team members are producer Mike Villers, First Person Arts is Dan Gashevsky and Becca Jennings, associate producers Jen Cleary and Ali L'Esperance. Our studio engineer is Charlie Kyer. Our archivist is Neil Barden. And the theme music is by Subglow. Thank you so much for listening.
Oh, we almost forgot. Cool news coming out of Philadelphia. The LGBTQ community has added two more stripes to the iconic rainbow flag, one black and one brown, to recognize the LGBTQ people of color.